Craggy Hill, as their host and the senior noble of their strategy council, sat at the head of the table. They'd been joined by Earl Stormkeep and Baron Larchros, and Bishop Amelaine and Larchros's chaplain, Father Erwain Yeer, were also present. Brian Selkir, the Earl of Deep Hollow, and Sir Adulfo Lincoln, the Duke of Blackwater, unfortunately had been unable to be present, which was the real reason Holland was taking notes. It wasn't the same as actually having them there would have been, but at least it would allow them to be brought up to date on any decisions which were actually made today. And whether they liked it or not, it was the only way coordination could be maintained, really. None of them cared for the notion of committing their plans and hopes to paper, even in the most secure cipher Mother Church could contrive. Yet it was less risky to rely on written messages than it would have been for all the members of their conspiracy to gather in one place and mark themselves out for the informants Anvil Rock and his son had undoubtedly put in place by now. For that matter, the Earl of Windshire had stationed 30 of his mounted constables here in Velena itself. They weren't getting much cooperation out of Craggy Hill's subjects, who were as insular and stubbornly loyal to their Earl as anyone could have asked. But simply hiding Craggy Hill's steadily growing number of armsmen was a problem. At the moment, he had them distributed among half a dozen manors, scattered across his earldom's hinterlands, where, hopefully, no one would realize each group was only one small part of the total force he was raising. It was easier to hide a few dozen, or even a few hundred armsmen, out in the countryside than it was to hide the comings and goings of great feudal knights, however.
Was there any indication of unrest in Manchia following Father Adrian's execution, my lord?
Shalaire asked now, looking across the table at Craggy Hill.
None, Your Eminence, the tall, powerfully built Earl replied unflinchingly.
That doesn't necessarily mean there wasn't any, Your Eminence,
Marak Holland pointed out diffidently, looking up from his notes. Shalaire's secretary had been close to Wyman, and there was a stubborn light in his eyes. This came over the official semaphore, he reminded his superior now.
You don't think Anvil Rock or Garvai, or especially Gerling, would admit to any such thing in an official communique, do you?
I'd like to think you might have a point, Father Marak,
Craggy Hill said before Shalaire could respond. The secretary looked at him and the Earl shrugged.
The message wasn't sent for general dissemination, Father, he explained almost gently. It was sent to me for my information as a member of the Regency Council, and it specifically reported that the capital was calm following the execution.
Holland's face tightened, and Shalaire felt his own trying to do the same thing.
So, Earl Stormkeep said after a moment, it sounds as if they've managed to turn the situation around, at least in Manchia.
I'm afraid they have, Craggy Hill confirmed.
He was the only member of the Regency Council who was an active party to the resistance, and all of the others watched his expression carefully.
I don't think Anvil Rock and Tartarian really trust me, he began, and I know that bastard Garvai and his arse-licker Doyle don't. On the other hand, if they had any concrete evidence against me, they would have acted on it by now. And whatever else we can say, Anvil Rock and Tartarian have been scrupulous about keeping all the members of the Council fully informed when we can't be personally in Manchir.
He grimaced.
They don't have much choice, given the terms of their authority under Parliament's grant, but I have to admit they've been more forthcoming in their reports than I would have anticipated. Because of that, I'm pretty sure they aren't lying or even misrepresenting their view of the situation when they say the arrest of Father Adrian and his associates seems to have broken the back of any effective resistance in Manchir itself.
The Earl paused for just a moment, gazing at Shalaire with oddly opaque brown eyes, then shrugged.
The truth is, Your Eminence, that Father Adrian seems to have badly underestimated Father Timon's popularity in Manchir. We knew he'd always been popular with the riffraff, the common city trash, but it would appear a sizable percentage of the better sort were listening to him, too. I don't say they agreed with him, but it seems pretty evident that his execution has inspired a general sense of outrage. And when Garvey followed that up by arresting Father Adrian and virtually his entire leadership group, and when he managed to turn up so much evidence, completely exclusive of any confessions, of all they'd already accomplished and of their future plans as well, it was fairly decisive.
"Wallace is right about that, Your Eminence, I'm afraid,"
Stormkeep said heavily. The Bishop Executor raised an eyebrow at him, and the Earl shook his head.
"Having the arrests follow so quickly on Hoskins' execution, especially when there'd been so few arrests prior to that, made Garvey look not simply decisive, but effective. A lot of people who'd been trying to decide where their true loyalties lay were wavering in large part because of uncertainty, the question of whether or not the Regency Council could provide stability. Whether its legs had the strength to stand. Well," he raised his right hand, palm uppermost, "the verdict seems to be in now, at least as far as Mancheer is concerned. And to be brutally honest, the restraint Gerling's shown is working in favor of a general acceptance of the authority of both the Regency Council and the Church of Caris."
"Restraint?"
Amelaine Garnot repeated, gazing incredulously at Stormkeep.
"He's had 5 priests of Mother Church, including the Archbishopric's legal intendant, and 21 brothers from St. Justin's hanged, my lord. Hanged by the secular authorities, in direct contravention of the writ. Another 25 or 30 priests and brothers are still in custody, secular custody, to serve prison terms. Prison terms for consecrated priests of God."
"That's true, Bishop Amelaine."
Stormkeep's voice was rather colder than the one in which he usually spoke to the bishop.
"On the other hand, assuming he's serious about claiming authority in the name of the Church of Coruscant, Gerling could just as easily have had all of them put to the question and sentenced to the full punishment of Schuler. As it happens, there's no evidence any of them, including Father Adrian, were even interrogated under duress. You and I may be aware of the enormity of Gerling's offense against Mother Church and God."
From his tone, Shalaire thought, the Earl was rather less impressed with the gravity of that offense than Garnot was.
"But the majority of the common folk aren't. They regard church law as the church's business, and what they see is that Archbishop Clermont could have had every single one of his prisoners put to the question for the murder of a priest before they were executed themselves. They may not be aware of everything else the Book of Schuler prescribes for that sort of an offense, but they know that much, and they know Gerling didn't do it. And the rest of the clergy, at the very least, do know that Schuler decrees the punishment for anyone convicted of priest-killing. As far as the people who see those things are concerned, my lord, that is restraint, and there's no point pretending otherwise. We have to deal with what is, not what we'd like to be, and deceiving ourselves is the best way I can think of to fail in our efforts to undo this entire abomination."
Garnot started to reply hotly, but Shalaire held up a restraining hand.
"Peace, Amelaine," he said quietly but firmly. "Earl Stormkeep spoke in nothing but the truth, I'm afraid. And he's right about the common folk leaving matters of church law to the church. For that matter, that's exactly what they ought to do. It's simply unfortunate that in this case, the men claiming to speak for Mother Church actually serve Shan Wei."
Garnot's expression was manifestly unhappy, but he settled back in his chair, obedient to Shalaire's gesture. The Bishop Executor gazed at him for a moment, then turned his attention back to Craggy Hill.
"It would seem from what you've said, and what Solomon said," he nodded at Stormkeep, "that for now, at least, we have no choice but to abandon any hope of a popular rising in Mancheer. Would you agree?"
"I'm afraid so, Your Eminence."
Craggy Hill leaned back in his own chair, tugging at an earlobe.
"It was always going to be difficult to coordinate Father Adrian's efforts with our own. And to be frank, the southeastern part of the princedom seems increasingly inclined to follow the capital's example. I tried to talk Anvil Rock and the others out of concentrating their efforts south of the Barkors, but I couldn't push too hard, and, unfortunately, they were too smart to spread their forces and their efforts as thinly as I wanted them to. He shrugged. As a result, they've been able to build themselves what amounts to a secure base, extending outward from the capital. I'm not trying to say they're entirely secure, but they do have Rokair, Tartarian, Eraith, Chorus, Derwin, and Manchir itself pretty much in their pockets. The northwest and west are more of a toss-up. They could go either way. Wind Daughter would probably break for the Regency Council at this point in any open confrontation. But the islanders don't have very much population. And that leaves us up here in the north, where at the moment Anvil Rock's and Tartarian's authority is shaky, to say the very least. "So what do you think they're planning, my lord?" Shiller asked. "I know exactly what they're planning, Your Eminence. I've sat in on enough of their meetings for that. In essence, their strategy is to continue to gradually expand their area of control, working outward from Manchir. It's not going to be quick, but they've decided that steady and successful is more important than quick, and they're not about to overreach themselves."
"Which gives us at least a little more time," Baron Larchros observed.
"Yes, but we can't afford to squander it," Stormkeep said forcefully.
Heads nodded around the table. Things had moved with frustrating slowness, despite their very best efforts. And every one of them was acutely aware of the hours and days trickling away.
"Well, the good news is that we may be able to begin moving after all," Craggyhill said.
The others looked at him, and he smiled sourly.
"Zebediah's finally ready to stop dancing around. Oh, he's still holding out for our guarantee of the recognition of complete Zebedian independence, under him, of course, but I think it's a formality at this point. At any rate, he's committed himself to providing us with the new model muskets we need, or some of them at least."
"He has?" Shiller straightened in his chair, eyes brightening. Although his secular associates had been steadily increasing their manpower, they were all only too conscious of their lack of weapons. They were too ill-supplied in that regard to arm the men they'd already raised, even with swords and pikes, and all of them combined had less than 400 muskets, all of them old-fashioned smoothbore matchlocks. Against Garvai's forces alone, they would be totally outclassed. Once Viceroy General Cherman put his marines, with their rifles and artillery, into the field in support, any form of armed uprising would be futile. It could result in nothing but a bloodbath for the resistance, especially now that the southeastern portion of the princedom was accepting the Regency Council's authority, and the Bishop Executor knew it. But now...
"Is it just the rifles, Wallace?" Stormkeep asked.
"Let's not poo-poo rifles, Solomon," Craggyhill replied with a sour smile. Stormkeep nodded in acknowledgement, and Craggyhill shrugged. "At the moment, he's promising only the rifles. He says we can have the first 400 or 500 within a month or so of reaching an actual agreement. Artillery is going to be harder, because Caleb's being so coy about making it available to Zebediah. Apparently, for some strange reason, he doesn't quite trust Zebediah."
From the expressions of his fellow conspirators, that didn't exactly come as a stunning revelation.
"That raises an interesting point, my lord," Garnot observed. "If Caleb's watching Zebediah, will he actually be able to divert enough rifles to make a difference?"
"I don't know," Craggyhill said frankly. "I do know that according to his envoy, he's already creatively lost somewhere around 200 rifles which were passing through Zebediah. Apparently, no one in Caleb's quartermaster's corps even noticed. However, the majority of the arms he's proposing to deliver to us will never officially enter Zebediah at all."
"I beg your pardon, my lord?"
Garnot's eyebrows rose, and Craggyhill snorted.
"I don't know how he's planning to manage it either, Bishop Amelain, but his envoy seems confident. Apparently, Zebediah hasn't lost any of his penchant for sneakiness. As nearly as I can put it together from what his envoys let slip, he's got a contact in Chisholm who's in a position to divert arms and material from their new Imperial army. As fast as they're expanding, and with everything that has to be going on while they worry about the church's counterattack, I wouldn't be surprised if someone with big enough balls, if you'll pardon the language, could manage to lose quite a few rifles or even artillery pieces if he were in the right position. And from what Zebediah's envoy is saying, it sounds like his contact in Chisholm is in the right position. Once again, heads nodded all around the table, this time with varying degrees of profound satisfaction. If Craggy Hill was right, then they were finally in a position to begin serious planning. If they had the weapons and the firepower to stand up to Garvai long enough, there were plenty of Temple loyalists who'd rally to their colors, and for the first time in far too long, they shared a sense of actual confidence. None of those nodding heads, however, were aware of the tiny, almost microscopic sensor remote clinging to the underside of one of the chamber's ceiling beams, while it eavesdropped on their entire conversation. 5. Imperial Palace, City of Chiraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm.
Merlin!
An Empress Charlian, whose pregnancy was just beginning to show, leapt to her feet as the tall, black-haired guardsman stepped through the door. It wasn't the way a crowned head of state normally greeted a mere captain of the Imperial Guard, but no one in the council chamber appeared conscious of any irregularity. Edward Seahamper, Charlian's personal armsman, had the duty inside the chamber. His face looked as if it were about to split in two around the fracture line of his enormous grin, and Emperor Caleb was no more than a step or two behind his wife, as the two of them closed in on Captain Athrawus. Prince Narmon of Emerald sat back in his own chair with a smile of welcome, whose genuine warmth would have astounded even Narmon as recently as a few months ago, and Archbishop Michael's smile was almost as broad as Seahamper's. "Your Majesty," Merlin replied as Charlian threw her arms around him in a hug which would have threatened the structural integrity of a mere flesh-and-blood ribcage, even if he was wearing a cuirass. His tone was matter-of-fact, almost bland, but it didn't fool any of those present, and he hugged her back carefully. "Took you long enough," Caleb observed, reaching out to clasp forearms with Merlin as Charlian moved aside to give him room. "It did take longer than I anticipated," Merlin confessed. "On the other hand, Angelic turned out to be a lot more impressive than I'd anticipated, too."
"We want to hear all about it," Charlian said.
Merlin's need to maintain the lowest profile possible, electronically speaking, had precluded the sort of daily conversations to which they'd become accustomed. He'd passed along enough information to keep them generally informed, but they knew little of the details.
"We want to hear all about it," Charlian continued, "but we don't have time for a full report right this minute. Marak and Mother will be here any time now, so anything that they're not cleared for is going to have to wait until later. Except for what you can squeeze in before they arrive, of course."
"Understood, Your Majesty," Merlin said, and bowed slightly.
Baron Greenmountain and Queen Mother Alana had been as surprised as almost everyone else when it had been announced Captain Athrawus would be withdrawing from court for an overdue period of meditation. They'd been less happy than some, too, given how handy Merlin had proved when it came to stopping assassination attempts. Still, they'd also recognized that Caleb's and Charlian's confinement to the palace, which the weather would have enforced even if there'd been no other factors to consider, provided an opportune window for him to do just that without jeopardizing their security. They also knew better than most how close he was to Charlian and Caleb, however. Now that he was back, they would probably give the Emperor and Empress at least a little time to welcome him home. On the other hand, this was supposed to be a working meeting,
and there were a great many details to settle before Caleb and Charlian departed for their scheduled return to Tellisburg at the end of the month. Under the circumstances, Merlin felt sure they'd be along shortly. Fortunately, Lieutenant Franz Austin, Merlin's second-in-command from Caleb's personal detail, had the duty section outside the council chamber. Austin knew about Merlin's visions and also knew Green Mountain and Alana hadn't been cleared for that knowledge. He could be relied upon to knock on the door and announce the First Counselor and Queen Mother's arrival instead of simply opening it and ushering them through. In the meantime, the short version is that unless something goes incredibly wrong, Angelica is going to get herself and all her people, and trust me, there are more of them than we ever suspected, safely out of the temple lands to Siddhar City. I've managed to figure out her arrangements from getting from there to Tellisburg as well, and I think they should work fine. It's going to be a bit ticklish in some ways, but she has an excellent relationship with the House of Quentin, and she's already booked passage on one of those Siddharmarkian ships with Carisian crews, which the Quentins appear to have acquired. He smiled broadly in remembered admiration, but then he sobered. The other good news is that she managed something quite extraordinary. She has Samuel Wilson's family and the families of four other vicars who were members of Wilson's circle with her. That's astonishing enough to be going on with, but she's managed to pull out 13 other vicars' families as well, from all over the temple lands. And she's managed to get Archbishop Jason out of Glacierheart and 16 more of the circle's bishops and bishops' executor and their families. He shook his head. That's over 200 men, women, and children Clinton and the Inquisition are searching everywhere for. When word gets out that they came up short on that kind of scale, it's not going to do a thing for Clinton's aura of omnipotence. My God! Caleb sounded almost reverent. How in the name of all that's truly holy did she manage it? Obviously, I haven't been able to ask her for the details, since I didn't even realize everything she was up to until I was already on my way back here. For that matter, I doubt I've actually found everything even now. But from what I've seen of the way she operates, it probably didn't take anywhere near the manpower Clinton's going to assume it did. I'd guess she was probably the only person outside the circle itself to whom Wilson had trusted the names of every member of his group. And if I had to pick the single most dangerous thing about her, from Clinton's perspective, it's that she plans ahead with a vengeance. I'd been keeping tabs on Kinnear myself, so I've got a pretty good feel for what she did in his case, and I'd guess she used the same technique with most of the others. With variations, of course. But put more simply, she identified the people most at risk because of their association with the Circle. And she arranged, years ago in Kinnear's case at least, a network to get them out quickly and quietly in an emergency. Her idea of how to maintain operational security makes anyone else we've seen yet, even you, Your Highness, he smiled at Narman, look positively garrulous, too. I'll guarantee you that not one of the people she was arranging to rescue knew any more about her plans than Kinnear himself did. That way, if one of them was taken, he couldn't expose the existence of the network to anyone else. And I'm just about as certain that the people she'd contacted to do the rescuing had no idea who she was or how to initiate contact with her. It was a cellular system, sleeper cells they used to call them back on old Earth, that was already in place and waiting long before Clinton discovered the Circle's existence. All she had to do was get the prearranged execution orders to her extraction teams. It sounds like we need to hire her to work for you, Narman, Caleb said, looking over at the rotund little Emeraldian with a flickering smile. It sounds to me, Your Grace, as if we need to create her own special bureau and put her in charge of clandestine operations, Narman replied very seriously indeed.
I've never attempted anything on the scale Merlin's describing, and certainly not right under the Inquisition's nose, but I think I have a feel of the difficulties, and for the degree of forethought and planning involved. I realize she had years, decades, to put all this in place, but I'm still deeply impressed. Well, Merlin's expression had been sober. Now it went positively grim.
I agree with you that I'm impressed, Your Highness, but don't expect her to be.
He inhaled deeply.
She may have gotten 200 people out. From what Owls picked up, though, Clinton's arrested almost 2,000.
2,000? Charlian repeated very softly and carefully, her tone stricken, and Merlin nodded slowly.
Wilson's circle was larger than we suspected, he said heavily. In addition to him and his brother, there were at least 20 other vicars.
There may well have been more. At this point, according to the remotes Owl left in Zion, he's arrested over 30. In addition, he's arrested the families of all of the accused vicars, aside from the ones Angelic got out, as well as every member of the vicar's personal staffs and their families. And they've arrested 50 bishops and archbishops, and all of their immediate families as well.
30 vicars?
Stainer shook his head, his expression as shocked as Merlin had ever seen it.
That's a tenth part of the entire vicarate.
I'm aware of that, Your Eminence, and I don't think he's done yet. It's obvious he's taking this opportunity to purge the vicarate of everyone he thinks might have the courage to oppose him.
And Merlin's Pika's face was carved granite. The Inquisition has already announced it intends to apply the full rigor of the Book of Schuler to any vile, forsworn, and damnable traitor who has betrayed his vows to God, the Archangels, and Mother Church, no matter who he may be or what office he may have attained, and to their families as well.
Charlian's hand rose to cover her mouth, and Caleb swore viciously in a savage undertone.
Narman's expression didn't actually change at all, and yet there was a peculiar hardening, an icy thing more sensed than seen, in his eyes. And Seahamper's expression was a fitting mirror for Caleb's fury. But Stainer's was, in many ways, the most frightening of all. Michael Stainer was a gentle, compassionate, and loving man. Anyone who'd ever met him realized that. But there was another side to that gentleness and compassion, a fiercely protective side. The side which had made him truly a shepherd. And at that moment, when Merlin looked at the Archbishop of Caris, what he saw was a shepherd standing between his flock and one of Safehold's six-legged catamounts, with a hunting spear in his hands and murder in his heart.
Will he really do it, do you think, Merlin?
Narman's tone of clinical detachment fooled none of them. All of them looked at him, and the Emeraldian shrugged.
What I mean is, do you think Trenaire, Maguire, and Duquesne will let him do something so stupid?
I don't know, Merlin replied frankly. Angelic has a far better feel for what's been happening inside the vicarate and the group of four than we did. From what she said, I think Duquesne would stop Clinton if he could, but Maguire's basically a non-entity. Worse, in Angelic's opinion, he probably agrees with Clinton about the need to crush any possible opposition. And I doubt he has either the moral courage or sufficient stature within the group of four to stop it, even if he wanted to. Trenaire's smart enough to recognize the damage this sort of excess could do, but I'm afraid he's desperate enough in the short term to go along. The question in my mind is whether or not Duquesne is going to try to stop Clinton, or recognize that he can't, that all he could accomplish would be to add another victim, this one from the group of four itself, to the list.
And I hate to say it, Narman, Caleb said harshly, but from their perspective, it may not seem stupid at all. Their fleets are getting close enough to completion that they'll be ready to at least begin their counterattack soon. At the same time, the group of four's prestige and authority have been badly damaged by all the reverses they've suffered to date. Not to mention the fact that the rest of the vicarate knows the entire war started solely because the group of four fucked up. I don't know about Duquesne,
but Clinton for sure, and Trenaire and Magwer almost as certainly, see this as an opportunity to re-establish an iron grip on the Vicarate. They're going to crush any possible internal voice of opposition, especially any voice that might have counseled moderation and victory, before they turn that new navy of theirs loose on us. And if they win, they're going to do exactly the same sorts of things to all our people. They think they're going to create so much terror, so much fear, no one will ever again dare to argue with their interpretation of God's will and their own power.
The Emperor's brown eyes were dark with the vision of the thing of horror the Church of God awaiting would become if the Group of Four won. In the long run, it will destroy them, and possibly even the Church, he went on, his voice still bitter and cold.
The kind of atrocity they're talking about, visited on so many men and women, and children, damn their black hearts to hell, who are all known to the rest of the Vicarate? Who are cousins and aunts and uncles of the rest of the Vicarate?
He shook his head with the grim assurance of a prophet. In the end, even those who are most terrified of them at this moment are going to remember. There may not be one of them with the guts and the moral courage to stand up to them now, but in the end, they'll remember even carrion lizards can pull down a great dragon, if there are enough of them and it's distracted.
So you're right, Narmin. It would be a stupid thing for them to do, ultimately, in the long term, in the fullness of time. But they aren't thinking about the long term. They're thinking about the present, right now, and possibly next month or next year. That's as far as their vision extends, and so I'm telling you, as surely as I'm standing here in this council chamber, at this moment, they are going to do this. God help us all.
His voice fell to a whisper.
They are going to do this.
6. Robert Ducairne's private chapel, the temple, city of Zion, the temple lands. Robert Ducairne knelt before the tiny altar, hands locked around a simple wooden scepter, his eyes fixed upon the icon of Langhorne with its golden upraised echo of the scepter he held in his own merely mortal hands, and felt the tears running down his face.
"Help me," he prayed. "Holy Langhorne, God, help me. I can't let this happen. I can't, not on top of everything else. This can't be what you want done in your name. Tell me how to stop it. Show me a way."
But the icon was silent. It returned no answer. And strain the ears of his soul though he might, he heard no whisper of God's voice in his heart. He closed his eyes, face twisted with anguish, squeezing the scepter he held so hard, he was amazed the carved wood didn't shatter in his grip. He'd thought he'd known what Clinton was going to do, and dreaded it, tried frantically to think of some way to stop it, even warned the intended victims. Yet his worst nightmares had fallen short of what was actually happening. Ducairne was the only member of the Group of Four Samuel Wilson had ever dared approach directly. So when Clinton started dropping his mysterious, smirking little hints last fall, Ducairne had been sinkingly certain who his targets were. But neither Trenaire nor Magwer had picked up on those hints. They'd known something was in the air, just as everyone else had, yet they'd been as surprised as any other members of the Vicarate when Clinton and his inquisitors actually struck. At first, they'd been inclined to be incredulous, to think Clinton must have overreacted. He wasn't known for his moderation, after all. But Clinton had been prepared for that, and Ducairne's grip on the scepter tightened still farther as he recalled the scene.
"What's the meaning of this, Jaspar?" Zamson Trenaire demanded.
The normally urbane and controlled Chancellor's voice was harsh, his expression tight with mingled anger and an undeniable edge of fear, as he confronted the Grand Inquisitor across the council table.
"I think that's plain enough," Clinton replied in a cold, dangerously level tone. I've been telling all of you for some time that we had traitors right here in the vicarate. I realize the three of you have been discounting my warnings, that you've gone your way comfortably assuming it's just a case of me once again seeing enemies in every shadow. Well, I won't say that hasn't happened in the past. I won't apologize for it either. It's better to be overly suspicious rather than blindly oblivious in the service of God and Schuler. But not this time. Oh no, not this time. These bastards have been conspiring against Mother Church, against the Grand Vicar's authority, against our struggle with the heretics in Caris, and against God himself. They can dress it up any way they want, try to justify it any way they choose, but the truth will come out. Trust me, the truth will come out.
Robert Duquerne could not recall ever having seen Jasper Clinton's expression so armored in assurance and so ribbed with iron determination. He radiated a terrifying power as he glowered at his three colleagues, crouched forward like a jowly, hot-eyed, furious great dragon about to open its vast maw and charge with a bellow of killing rage. The treasurer started to open his mouth, although he had absolutely no idea what he was going to say. While he hesitated, searching for words, Trinaire sat back in his chair, his eyes intent, and spoke first. "What truth, Jasper?" he asked. "I know Wilson and his brother were always critics, always pains in the arse. And I know they were dangerous, to us at least. But there's a world of difference between that and what you're accusing them of now. And all of these arrests, midnight seizures of women and children. Langhorn man, can't you see what this is going to do? Do you think all those people aren't related to other families throughout the Temple Lands? Some of them are related to me, for God's sake. How do you think the rest of the vicarate's going to react if they think their families are going to be threatened with something like this just because we think they're opposing our policies?"
"Is that what you think this is?"
Clinton stared at Trinaire in disbelief.
"Oh, it would have given me immense pleasure to take that sanctimonious bastard and his brother down. Don't think for a moment that it wouldn't have. But this isn't something I've manufactured just to quash an enemy, Zomson. This is something that came to me. It's a conspiracy that extends far beyond Wilson and his brother. And it's only God's own mercy I found out about it at all."
"What kind of conspiracy? And just how did you find out about it?"
Trinaire demanded, his skepticism eroding slightly before Clinton's tone of steely certitude.
"They've been conspiring to overthrow the Inquisition and its God-given authority as the first step in their plan to recognize the legitimacy of the Church of Caris,"
Clinton said flatly.
"They've been gathering material they believed they could use to blackmail other vicars, extort their support against us and the Grand Vicar as a means to do just that. They've been working steadily to undermine fundamental church doctrines, including the doctrine of the Grand Vicar's infallibility when he speaks in Langhorn's name, and planning to undermine Mother Church's central authority by actually supporting the demands of people like Stainer and his so-called reformists for the local election of bishops. I think all of that constitutes a fairly significant threat to Mother Church and God's plan for safehold, Zomson. And it doesn't even begin to get into some of the things we've discovered about their personal degeneracy."
Duquerne felt a sudden surge of nausea at hearing someone like Clinton, of all people, accuse someone else of degeneracy. Yet even he was a bit taken aback by the catalogue of the Grand Inquisitor's other accusations. He never doubted that Clinton had twisted and misconstrued everything Samuel and Howard Wilson had been trying to accomplish. The treasurer had that terrifying note Howard had slipped him as evidence. But he was frighteningly confident that Clinton could sell his interpretation of their intentions to a lot, possibly even a majority, of the other vicars. Those other vicars were already terrified of the consequences of the war with Caris, and the reports of more and more reformist-inclined clergy going over to the Church of Caris in places like Emerald and Coruscant would only make them even more suspicious of, more frightened by, the specter of betrayal from within.
"Those are serious accusations," Trenaire said, and this time the Chancellor sounded shaken, even a little frightened. "And you still haven't told us how you came to discover all of this? And why you didn't tell all of us about it at the time?"
"I didn't tell the rest of you about it first because it was the Inquisition's business, not yours," Clinton said bluntly. "Langhorne and Schuler established the Inquisition expressly to deal with this sort of internal rot. I didn't need to consult with anyone else to recognize what my office and my own vows required of me. Second, I didn't tell the rest of you, or anyone outside of Willem Reyno and a handful of senior inquisitors whose ability to keep their mouths shut I unreservedly trusted, because it was essential the conspirators not know I'd become aware of their actions until Winter trapped them here in Zion, and I'd had time to complete my preliminary investigations and arrange to seize all the guilty parties simultaneously. I'm not saying any of you would have deliberately warned someone capable of this sort of damnable treason."
His eyes flipped briefly to Robert Ducairne's face, and those eyes had gone cold instead of hot.
"But even a single incautious word in the wrong spot could have warned them before I was ready. You have no idea how far their nets extended, how deeply into the staffs of other vicars and other archbishops their corruption had spread. As for how I discovered it, I wish I could take credit for that, but I can't."
Ducairne's eyes weren't the only ones that widened in astonishment as Jaspar Clinton disavowed the credit for discovering a conspiracy on the scale of the one he'd just described.
"As it happens," he continued, "someone who'd been recruited by the conspirators and recognized where they were actually headed brought it to my attention."
"Who?"
Ducairne heard his own voice demand. Clinton gazed at him silently, almost thoughtfully for a moment, then nodded. He pushed back his chair with a little grunt of effort, stalked to the chamber's door, and opened it.
"Yes, Your Grace,"
the purple-cassocked inquisitor outside the door said.
"Fetch him,"
Clinton said flatly.
"At once, Your Grace."
The inquisitor bowed, then turned and walked swiftly down the corridor, while Clinton returned to his place at the table. He sat back down, folded his arms across his chest, and sat silent, waiting. The wait wasn't as long as it felt, Ducairne was certain of that, yet it seemed forever before the door opened once more and the Inquisitor returned. He was accompanied by another man, this one in the orange-trimmed white cassock of an archbishop.
"I believe all of you know the Archbishop of Hanke," Clinton said.
Ducairne's eyes narrowed. He did indeed know Nicholas Stanton, the Archbishop of Hanke, although not well. Their paths had crossed on several occasions, especially where the details of Hanke's finances were concerned, but he'd never actually gotten to know Stanton. Now he considered the obviously frightened man in front of him, wondering what lay behind that exquisitely tailored facade. There was something dark in Stanton's brown eyes, and his hands trembled visibly before he concealed them in the sleeves of his cassock.
"Nicholas came to me last May," Clinton continued. "He sought me out because he had become aware of a truly horrendous plot by so-called men of God right here in the vicarate. They'd approached him, and for some time, as he will freely confess, he allowed himself to be deceived and taken in by their lies. They convinced him their goal was simply to reform certain abuses within Mother Church."
The Grand Inquisitor smiled thinly.
"Does that sound like what we're hearing from other lands? About reformists trampling all over one another in their eagerness to betray Mother Church to Stenair and his heretics?"
Ducairne felt his heart sink as he realized how that question was going to resonate with other frightened vicars. Indeed, he saw a flicker in Trenaire's eyes, and it was obvious from Magwer's expression that he was prepared to embrace whatever expedient was required,
to crush any reformist plot coming from inside the temple.
At first, Nicholas was so impressed by their apparent sincerity and devoutness that he allowed himself to be taken in,
Clinton went on, after letting his question sink fully home.
In time, however, he came to realize their actual objectives were rather more sinister. Then this business with Karis erupted. In their eagerness to seize the opportunity they believed it presented, they made the mistake of coming a bit too far out into the open, and he began to see things he hadn't seen before, including the evidence of deeply hidden personal corruption. He was, I think, understandably frightened, both by what he was discovering and by how Mother Church and the Office of Inquisition might respond to his own involvement. It took him some time and a great deal of prayer to realize it was his duty to bring all this to my attention, to lay it before me, so Mother Church might defend herself against this attack out of the night. He recognized the personal risk he ran in informing me of it, yet he was resolved to do so, and he did.
He was so terrified of what you'd do to all of them if you found out on your own that he came to you to sell the others out and buy the best personal terms he could, you mean,
Ducairne thought coldly.
May we hear this from Archbishop Nicholas himself?
Trinair asked in a painfully neutral tone.
Of course you may.
Clinton sounded almost exasperated, as if he couldn't believe there'd ever been any question in Trinair's mind, and glanced at the waiting, silent archbishop.
Tell them, Nicholas.
Yes, Your Grace, Stanton replied.
He looked at the other three vicars, cleared his throat, and swallowed hard. Then he drew a deep breath.
It's as the Grand Inquisitor has already described, Your Graces.
His voice quivered slightly, yet he met their eyes squarely.
At first, I genuinely believed Vicar Samuel and Vicar Howard had only Mother Church's best interests at heart. In fact, I believed that for several years. It was only gradually that certain parts of what they said began to sound as if they were contradicting other parts, and even then, I was able to convince myself I'd simply misunderstood. But they had me doing things which made me uncomfortable. Spying on my fellow bishops and archbishops, gathering information about members of the vicarate, even the Grand Vicar himself, looking especially for evidence which might have been used to blackmail or pressure members of the Inquisition, and in addition for anything which might have been used as a weapon against the Chancellor, the Grand Inquisitor, and the Treasurer.
He paused, as if gathering his thoughts, then continued.
I began to realize that what they were gathering was information which might be used against personal enemies in the vicarate. That concerned me deeply, especially when I began to discover certain unpleasant aspects of their own lives.
His mouth twisted briefly in what might have been a grimace of distaste, or perhaps fear.
I've found that behind the virtuous facade they strove to present, they were actually dedicated to a personal licentiousness that shocked me. Your Graces, I'm no prude and no stranger to reality. I know bishops, archbishops, even vicars are still men, that all of us are still prone to the temptations of the flesh, and that too often we succumb to them. I'm not prepared to condemn any of my brothers in God for being weak, because all mortals are weak and fallible. But there are perversions at which I must draw a line. Unnatural lusts and the abuse of children are more than I could endure.
Ducairne's eyes widened. Surely Clinton didn't think he could sell that to the rest of the vicarate? Not about Samuel and Howard Wilson, of all men. Yet even as he thought that, he was struck by how damnably sincere and convincing Stanton sounded. By the way, men already eager to justify the destruction of someone they'd been convinced was their enemy would seize upon such additional charges.
Well, now I know what terms you made when you sold your soul, Stanton, he thought coldly.
As my eyes were opened, Stanton continued,
I began to see even more things I'd sought not to see. And then came the war with Karis, and suddenly they were all excited, all eager, over the opportunity, the opening, our initial defeats offered them. I became aware that they didn't care if Mother Church shattered, so long as they were able to assert their own control over whatever remained in the wreckage. They were perfectly prepared for the Church of Karis to grow and prosper, if that would allow them to impose their own doctrinal reform here in Zion and appoint themselves the rulers of Mother Church. The Archbishop of Hanky shook his head sadly, his expression that of a man who had been betrayed by those he had trusted, rather than a man who was busy betraying those who had trusted him. Once I realized the truth, Your Graces, I decided I had no choice but to take my knowledge and suspicions to the Grand Inquisitor, which I did. And after he'd heard my confession, he said...
Robert Duquerne returned to the present, opened his eyes, and stared once again, imploringly, at the icon on the altar. But still the icon made no answer to his silent, anguished plea. Stanton had turned the trick, he thought hopelessly. Duquerne didn't know if Trenaire really believed a single word about the supposed perversions of the Wilson's inner circle, but he suspected Magware had convinced himself it was the truth. Yet what he knew Trenaire did believe was that Samuel and Howard Wilson and their associates had been determined to wrest control of the temple from the Group of Four. And, Duquerne thought, the Chancellor also believed the Wilsons truly had been prepared to entertain a negotiated settlement with the Church of Karis, one which would have recognized that heretical church's right to exist. It was debatable which of those would have appeared as the greater treason, the greater threat to Zomson Trenaire. Either would probably have been enough to incline him to support Clinton. Both of them together had definitely done the trick. And so Robert Duquerne found himself the only member of the Group of Four who recognized, or would admit, even to himself at any rate, what Jaspar Clinton really intended. The only possible voice which could be raised against the madness. Yet he was an isolated voice, and not just within the Group of Four. All the rest of the vicarate was aware of the way in which he had turned his focus back to his personal faith, and in the process, he'd spent a great deal of time in the same circles as Samuel and Howard Wilson. The same circles as several, indeed the majority, of the vicars who had been seized as conspirators with the Wilson brothers. The shock of what had happened to the Wilsons when the Inquisition sought to arrest them had gone through the vicarate like a thunderbolt. One vicar killed by another, by his own brother, to prevent his arrest? The murderer slain in pitched combat against the temple guard itself? And why had Howard killed Samuel? To spare his brother from the question and the punishment? Or to silence a voice which might have condemned him under interrogation? Duquerne's eyes burned. He knew exactly why Howard had done what he'd done, and he remembered the way Howard had looked into his own eyes on the day he passed him that note. He knew what Howard had expected of him on that day. But he could also hear the mob rising behind Clinton, the voices driven by panic into shrill denunciations, into fevered pledges of loyalty, into passionate demands for vengeance upon those who would betray Mother Church. Anything to keep Clinton and the Inquisition pointed away from them and their families. He couldn't stop it. The thought burned through him suddenly, cold and clear, as he stared at the icon of Langhorne. He couldn't stop it, not now. No one could. If he tried, he would simply be added to the list of victims, and it was entirely probable that his own family, his brothers, his sister, and their families, would be delivered to the Inquisition with him. He shrank from the thought of what would happen to them there, of the accusation in their eyes as they suffered all the horrors Schuller had prescribed,
and knew it was all because he had sacrificed them in his vain attempt to assuage his own conscience by opposing Clinton.
That wouldn't be what actually happened,
he thought despairingly, his mind filled with the terror and the accusation and the betrayal in his niece's and nephew's eyes.
But it's what they would think, what they would feel, what they would suffer. I have the right to destroy myself. Do I have the right to destroy them right along with me?
Yet even if he had that right, it would accomplish nothing. Nothing except the removal of the one voice within the group of four which might have opposed it.
It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter. I may not always know what's right, but I know what's wrong. And I'm a vicar. I'm a priest. I'm a shepherd. Langhorn himself says, the good shepherd sacrifices his life for the sheep. It doesn't get any plainer than that. And yet...
He closed his eyes, thinking once more of the note Howard Wilson had handed him, of the demand it made, the hope it offered, and the promise it had required of him. If he sacrificed himself now, at this moment, the way his priestly office demanded, that hope would die with him, and the promise would wither, unfulfilled. He remembered the passion in Howard's eyes that morning, remembered Samuel Wilson's gentle smile, and his delight in doing God's will, remembered his love for his own family, remembered the baying hounds gathering at Clinton's heels, and pressed his forehead against the scepter in his hands. April, Year of God, 894. 1. Royal Palace, City of Talkeira, Kingdom of Delphirach.
Is it as bad as the reports all say it is, Philip?
Iris Dakin asked somberly. She and Earl Corus stood in one of her favorite spots, looking out across Lake Erden from the window of a small hanging turret. One reason it was one of her favorite spots was the view of the enormous lake, especially at this time of day, with the sun setting in red and gold splendor beyond its farther shore. Another reason was its convenience, since it gave directly onto the sitting room of the small suite she'd been assigned in the central keep of King James's castle. But the most important reason was that this particular spot was immune to eavesdropping. She only wished there were another spot somewhere in the entire castle where that was equally true. At the moment, a bald-headed man in his 40s, with a thick version of what had once been called a walrus mustache on a planet called Old Earth, and a nose which had obviously been broken more than once, stood outside her suite to ensure she and her guardian were not disturbed. His name was Tobias Raymer, Sergeant Tobias Raymer, recently retired, in a manner of speaking, from the Royal Coruscantian Army. Raymer hadn't been part of her original entourage, but Captain Joel Harris, who'd managed to get her and her brother out of Coruscant in one piece, had recommended Raymer to Corus. He was, the captain had said, not only loyal and stubborn, but also good with his hands, so perhaps he might be of service to His Highness during his visit to Delphirach. In the months since, both Corus and Iris had concluded that Captain Harris had known what he was talking about, and Raymer had quietly assembled a small, competent, and completely unofficial royal guard for their 9-year-old prince. Only one of them was a Delphirachan, and all of them were paid directly by Iris, using discretionary funds Corus had hidden away in various mainland accounts for the use of her father's spy networks. As a result, their primary loyalty was to her, and Divan, and not to King James. James had put up with it so far, undoubtedly because, assuming he was even aware Divan's guard existed in the first place, it was so small. There were only 12 men in it, after all. At the moment, Corus wished there were 1,200. He gazed at the princess, considering her question. She would be 18 in another 2 months, yet she looked 10 years older, and her hazel eyes were intent, dark with a worry she was careful to let very few see. Those were not the eyes of a young woman, a girl her age, Corus thought sadly. But they were the eyes of someone to whom he owed the truth.
"Actually, I'm afraid it's probably worse than the reports say," he said quietly.
He looked away for a moment, gazing out across the crimson sheet of lake water.
"What we've seen so far are the official reports," he continued, "the preliminary reports. They're still setting the stage, I'm afraid."
His lips tightened.
"When Clinton's ready, the reports are going to get a lot worse."
"May God and Langhorne have mercy on their souls," Iris murmured.
It was her turn to stare unseeingly at the lake for several seconds.
"How much truth do you think there is to the charges?"
she asked even more quietly then, and Corus inhaled deeply. That was a dangerous question. Not just for her to be asking, even here, where he was virtually certain there were no unfriendly ears to hear, but for her even to be thinking.
"And do you think she's not already thinking them, Philip?" he asked himself sarcastically. "Do you really want my honest answer, Iris?" he asked softly.
She met his eyes levelly and nodded.
"Very well," he sighed. "Obviously, we can't really know from this far away, but in my opinion, there's no truth to at least 90% of Clinton's accusations. In fact, there may well not be any truth to them."
"Then why?" Her tone was almost pleading. "If it isn't true, then why arrest them? Why accuse them of something that carries such a horrible penalty?"
"Because," Corus began, then paused.
Iris Dakin was a highly intelligent young woman, and one who understood political maneuvers. If she truly couldn't answer those questions for herself, he would have preferred more than almost anything else in the world, to leave her in that state of ignorance.
"But the truth is, she already knows," he told himself sadly. "She just hasn't wanted to believe it. In fact, she's probably wanted so badly not to believe that she's half convinced herself her suspicions are wrong, but only half."
"Your Highness, Iris," he said. "I don't doubt Vicar Samuel and Vicar Howard were doing something Clinton considered treasonous. The truth, unfortunately," he met her eyes unflinchingly, "is that Clinton's definition of treason has very little to do these days with treachery against Mother Church or God, and a great deal to do with opposition to him. My own reports and analyses of the vicarate's internal politics make it clear Samuel Wilson was Clinton's only real rival for the post of Grand Inquisitor, and he was a very different man from Clinton. I have no doubt he was horrified by many of the Group of Four's actions over the last couple of years. Given what's been reported to me about his personality, I'd be very surprised if he hadn't been trying to do something to at least moderate Clinton's excesses. And that, I'm afraid, would have been more than enough justification, in Clinton's mind, for having him and any of his associates arrested." Iris's eyes had flinched very slightly at the word excesses. It was the first time he'd used that particular word, his most open statement of disagreement with the official keeper of Mother Church's soul. Yet her only surprise was that he'd finally used it, not that he felt that way.
"But to order his arrest, their arrest, on charges like these," she said, "charges which will condemn them to such horrible punishment, and to arrest entire families as well."
She shook her head and Corus grimaced.
"Iris," he said as gently as he could, "Clinton chose those charges because of the penalty they carry. Oh, he needed alleged crimes serious enough to justify the arrest and removal of members of the vicarate itself, but his real reasons, his true reasons, are, first, to find charges which permanently and completely discredit his critics, and secondly, to punish those critics so severely no one will dare to take their places when they're gone.
He's trying to deter anyone from opposing him or the group of four's policies and strategy. And this is his way of warning any of those would-be opponents of exactly how unwise of them it would be to even hint at criticizing them.
He saw something flicker in her eyes. It puzzled him for a moment, but then he realized what it had been.
"You're thinking about your father, aren't you?" he thought. "Thinking about how he sometimes punished someone more harshly in order to deter others from committing the same offense. And you really are smart, Iris. Little though you might want to think that about your own father, you know there were other things he did, things he never discussed with you, that had very little to do with justice and quite a lot to do with deterrence."
"So you think he really will inflict the punishment of Schuler on them?"
"I'm afraid the only real question is whether or not he'll inflict the punishment on their families as well," Corus said sadly.
Iris inhaled sharply, fresh horror filling her eyes, and he reached out and touched her cheek gently, something he almost never did.
"But the children, Philip," she said pleadingly, raising her own hand and cupping it over the hand on her cheek. Her voice was barely a whisper. "Surely he'll spare?"
She broke off as Corus shook his head sadly, gently.
"They're not children to him, Iris, not anymore. At best, they're the spawn of traitors and heretics. Worse, they're pawns. They'll be more useful to Mother Church and him as warnings to future traitors."
He shook his head again.
"No, I think the only question is whether he'll settle for simply having the children executed rather than subjecting them to the punishment of Schuler as well."
Iris looked physically ill, and Corus didn't blame her. Some of those children would be mere infants, in some cases still babes in arms, and it wouldn't matter one bit to Jaspar Clinton. Not any more than... He chopped that thought off quickly. Iris, he knew, remained convinced Caleb Armagh had ordered her father's and her brother's assassinations. In many ways, he wished her mind were more open to other possibilities, especially the one which had begun to look to him more and more like a certainty where Jaspar Clinton was concerned. But as he saw the worry, the sickness in those hazel eyes, he felt a familiar hesitation. She was already deeply concerned for her little brother's safety. Did he want to add to that concern? Fill her with even more worry and fear? For that matter, her own best defense against Clinton might well reside in her obvious, ongoing ignorance of the part Corus had become certain the Grand Inquisitor had played in Hector's and his son's murders. As long as she remained passionately and openly convinced of Caleb's guilt, she was useful to Clinton. Another voice, a highly visible voice, condemning Caleb and Charlian and all of Corus for the crime. Yet another source of legitimacy for anyone in Coruscant tempted to resist the Carizian annexation of that princedom. But if she ever once openly questioned Caleb's guilt, she would go instantly from the category of mildly useful to the category of liability in Clinton's mind. And if that happened... "They got in his way," the Earl of Corus said, instead of what he'd been thinking about saying. "And he's not going to overlook the fact that so many of the people who might oppose him are also fathers and mothers. Can you think of a single threat which could be more effective than that?" He asked the question quietly, and after a moment she shook her head in mute reply. "Of course you can't." Corus's lips worked like a man who wanted to spit out something rotten, and he looked back out the window at the lake, at the pure cold water of the lake. "Of course you can't," he said softly. "And neither can Jaspar Clinton, which is why he'll do it, Iris. Never doubt it for a moment. He will do it."
2. Robert Ducairn's office, the temple, city of Zion, the temple lands.
"Robert, you can't keep doing this," Zomson Trenaire said flatly.
Doing what?
Robert de Cairn asked calmly, almost coldly, looking up from the endless sea of paperwork which flowed across his desk daily.
You know perfectly well what.
Trenaire closed the door of Ducairn's private office behind himself and crossed to stand before the other vicar's desk.
Do you think Jaspar is the only one who's noticed what you're doing, or not doing? He demanded.
Ducairn sat back in his chair, elbows on the armrests, and gazed at the Chancellor of the Church of God Awaiting. As always, the office was perfectly, restfully lit and exactly the right temperature. The chair, as always, was almost unbelievably comfortable under him. The walls, as always, bore a slowly, almost imperceptibly changing mosaic of fresh green trees growing against the backdrop of distant blue mountains. And the air, as always, was filled with the gentle sound of background music. It was all a jarring, almost, no, not almost, obscene contrast to the horrors Jaspar Clinton's Inquisition was even then visiting upon men, women, and children in God's name.
What is it precisely I'm not doing, Zomson? He asked. Tell me, am I failing to participate in the judicial murder of my fellow vicars? Failing to applaud the torture of women, wives, who probably didn't even know what their husbands were doing, assuming their husbands were actually doing anything at all? Failing to lend the seal of my approval to the decision to have 16-year-old girls burned to death because their fathers pissed Jaspar off? Is that what I'm failing to do, Zomson?
Trenaire's eyes widened at Ducairn's cold, biting contempt. He gazed at the other vicar for a long moment, then his own eyes fell, and he stood looking at Ducairn's desktop, until, finally, he raised his eyes once again.
It's not that simple, Robert, and you know it, he said.
On the contrary, it's exactly that simple, Ducairn responded. You may argue that there are other factors involved, other considerations, but that doesn't make a single question I just asked you any less valid or less pertinent. You can lie to yourself about that if you want, but I won't. Not anymore.
Don't you understand how Jaspar's going to react if you start saying things like that to someone else?
Trenaire's eyes were almost pleading.
If he even thinks you're trying to inspire some sort of resistance to the Inquisition?
The Chancellor's voice trailed off, and Ducairn shrugged.
To my own shame, he said flatly, I'm doing nothing of the sort. I'm keeping my mouth shut, and may God forgive me for it. Because, believe me, Zomson, if I thought for one single moment that I could inspire some effective resistance, that I could stop this atrocity, I would do it. I would do it if I knew I would die tomorrow myself for the doing.
He met Trenaire's gaze flatly, unflinchingly, and tension hummed between them, singing in the depths of the office's silence. Something deep inside Zomson Trenaire quailed before Ducairn's unwavering eyes. Something which had once believed it too was a true vocation to serve God's will. He'd always thought that, in many ways, Robert Ducairn was the weakest of the group of four. Far smarter and more principled than Elaine Magware, perhaps, but ultimately flawed. Unwilling to face what had to be done in the service of maintaining Mother Church's authority. He was the sort of man prepared to look the other way, to acquiesce when someone else was willing to do what must be done, so long as it was not required of him. Most of the Chancellor still thought that, but not all of him. Not that something in himself which had once believed.
Maybe he is still like that, he thought. Maybe all this regenerated faith of his is only another way to avoid doing the unpleasant things. But I don't think it is, not really. If that were all it was, he wouldn't antagonize Jaspar this way. And he sure as Shan Wei wouldn't antagonize me when I'm the only potential ally against Jaspar he can possibly hope to find. If Jaspar ever hears you say something like that,
Trenaire heard his own voice saying almost conversationally,
The fact that you're a member of the Group of Four won't save you. You do realize that, don't you? That you might as well go ahead and oppose him openly?
I could find myself in far worse company, Duquesne replied levelly.
But not in any debtor company.
Probably not. Which is why you're the only one I've said it to. Of course, you can always go and tell him what I said, couldn't you? On the other hand, if you do that, and he does to me what he's already done to so many other men and women we've known all our lives, then you'll be all alone with him and Elaine, won't you? How long do you think you'll last? Especially when you're the one the Grand Vicar listens to, the only person with a source of authority which might rival that of the Inquisition. Once he starts worrying about traitors in our own ranks.
Trenaire felt his jaw trying to drop. He restrained the impulse with the experience of decades of political infighting. Yet the acuity of what Duquesne had just said shocked him.
And he's right, damn him. I can't afford to have Jaspar thinking that way. And I can't afford to let Robert go down either. Because as long as he's still here, I can always divert Jaspar into going after him if I have to. Once he's gone. All right, I won't deny. I can't deny your point, Trenaire admitted out loud. I don't want to be the only potential voice of opposition now that he's got the bit between his teeth. But that's not going to keep you alive and in one piece if you antagonize him badly enough. I may have selfish reasons to not want to see anything happen to you. But it won't do you any good if I go down with you either, and I'm not willing to do that.